The following is a production of University Laboratory High School in Urbana and WILL AM 580.
From 79 on, you can just see the women's soccer programs across the country in terms of the numbers of programs that have just grown since that point in time. And I just was fortunate to be right at the beginning of that growth of women's soccer at the college level.
Teachers of the school heard kids saying racial slurs, and so when they brought our team in, I remember really having to say, I don't particularly care what your belief system is regarding my race, but you will respect me, period.
So I went to the soccer practice, and it was nothing like I thought it was going to be. Chairs are crashing and banging, bodies are flying, and I thought, this is real sport. A whole new world opened up to me.
Sports have been an activity of people all over the world since ancient times, but the opportunity to play sports has not always been open to all people. The University of Illinois has been a leader in making sports accessible to people of different genders, races, and abilities.
The 2011 sub-freshman class at Uni High in Urbana conducted interviews with 16 past and present U of I athletes and administrators who shared their stories, how they overcame discrimination in sports, and how the U of I played an important part in their development.
WILL Radio proudly presents their stories in Competing Against Discrimination, Achieving Equality in Athletics at the University of Illinois. I'm Maria Gao.
And I'm Ann Macheski. Women have come a long way in athletics when we look at the struggles for equality. Even a short 4 decades ago, females could play sports only through recreational competitions in elementary and middle school. At the college level, playing competitively was out of the question. However, the passage of Title IX in 1972 changed women's athletics across the country, including at the University of Illinois. Title IX states that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. But implementation of the law was not without its struggles. Many changes were required before women's athletics could be truly considered on equal footing with their male counterparts.
My parents were very, very big on me being in athletics. Once I got to be about 5, I was outside playing in my neighborhood. And in my neighborhood, you got to understand, there's all boys. All the boys were a good 3 to 4 years older than me. And they would go outside and they'd have running races. And so I said, oh, I want to be in it. And they thought, oh, well, whatever. Well, I ended up beating all of them.
Soccer sort of really became something that the family did on the weekend. We all played a lot of different sports, but during soccer season, we were sort of all were involved. So a Saturday might be, I'd have a game, my brother would have a game, I'd coach 2 of my younger sisters in a game, my dad would coach 2, and then my brother, my dad, and I would referee a game. And so that made it kind of fun.
We saw the boys having, you know, all these opportunities. So I don't know where we got our courage, but a group of about 4 or 5 of us went into the principal's office, and he was an old football coach, very gruff, and we kind of demanded that we have the same opportunities. So the next year they offered 4 sports, and we were just so thrilled to have the chance to compete.
In the late 1960s and early 70s, the U of I began to focus on women's athletics. Some people worried that this would hurt men's athletics, but students, faculty, and administrators at the university worked towards the goal of creating opportunities in sports for both genders.
I was asked to be the first assistant director of athletics at Illinois, so that opened up the door pretty handily to begin athletic programs that would compete at the college level. I was one of the first ones that had that job description in the country, and in 1972, The people who were interested in women's sports and women's athletics started a governance association by the name of the Association of Intercollegiate Athletics for Women. To get things underway, I was sent to Washington to talk to the Senate Committee on the role of athletics for women on the college campus, namely Illinois. I was the first woman to represent their institution in Washington on that topic. So there were a lot of battles to be fought. A lot of people didn't want to do a lot of things. You know, they thought that women's athletics, you know, would kill the goose that laid the golden egg, meaning football and men's basketball. But after the first 10 years or so of being in operation, it was very clear men hadn't lost any ground financially, and we hadn't gained a whole lot financially, but we were getting better at getting more things that needed to be put into place. For example, things like practice clothes versus no practice clothes. Women didn't have them, men did. Going on trips and stuff, took the same kind of transportation, had the same per diem for both men and women. But basically, we tried to provide the same kind of opportunities and the same kind of benefits to both men and women. And that was a huge undertaking.
In the wake of acknowledgement that Title IX applied to college athletics, universities strategized on how to bring equality to women's sports. One way that schools could show compliance was to have the same number of sports for men and women. As a result, athletic opportunities for women grew tremendously.
Title IX was driven toward education and opportunities in education that would be equal for both men and women. So, in other words, there was a major push to open up opportunities for women and men alike to have full choice of their educational opportunities. Extracurricular activities were to function much the same way, in that whatever opportunities were available for one gender, they would be available for the other.
You know, when I was in junior high till about the time I got to college, you saw a huge growth in women's sports, and a lot of it was due to Title IX. I call myself a Title IX product for sure. I was born in 61, so I was about 11 years old when Title IX was first signed. It probably wasn't until I was in college that I sort of realized what Title IX had done while I was in college. And so that's when I really started to understand the implications that Title IX had. I think even in high school, the thought of playing college soccer didn't really exist because there weren't really many college soccer programs. And I think from 79 on, you can just see the women's soccer programs across the country in terms of the numbers of programs that have just grown since that point in time. And I just was fortunate to be right at the beginning of that growth of women's soccer at the college level.
Due to the university's support for women's sports, female coaches and athletes at the U of I generally feel that they are being treated equally to men. Today, men and women on the campus have an equal athletic and academic opportunity, which wasn't the case even 15 years ago. But in 1993, the U of I dropped three men's athletic varsity teams: swimming, fencing, and diving.
In terms of how the athletes are treated, I can honestly say, as someone here at Illinois, that the female athletes are given every opportunity to succeed on and off the field of competition. And I think that's what Illinois is all about. It has an academic part to it, too. And athletes are given an opportunity to really pursue both of their interests without one having to limit the other. And I think male and female athletes are given that opportunity on an equal basis. And I think that's true in a lot of programs across the country. There's a lot of equality that didn't exist, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago.
Because of Title IX, athletic opportunities for women have increased. Society has become more accepting of the fact that women now share positions that men once dominated.
I just read an article about a female umpire that was going to work a Major League Baseball game in spring training. I think she's only the second woman to have that chance to do that, and hopefully that will open the doors for more women to be able to go into that field. I think women have been held back a little bit.
You know, I think you're seeing more females who have gone through this that are now becoming athletic directors and becoming CEOs of companies, and now they get to make some choices about where they spend their corporate money. That corporate money now might go and support further opportunities in terms of women in sports and women in athletics and women in athletic careers. And you're going to see more women sports writers and women sportscasters and women broadcasters and women behind the camera and in front of the camera. And you're going to see a lot of opportunities not just as an athlete playing in sports, but in all of the opportunities that sports provides women. So my generation is going to provide more opportunities for yours, and yours will provide more for the generation that comes behind you, because you will appreciate and know how valuable your experience as an athlete was in preparing you for life after athletics.
Today, women have the same opportunities as men, but there is one key difference: their fans. Crowds for most women collegiate athletic events are much smaller compared to the thousands who pay big bucks to see the men's games of the same sport.
There's still a lot of areas where Title IX hasn't made the impact that it should. I think some of the same differences exist now that existed then. Are we going to get the same media coverage as Bruce Weber and his basketball team? Not right now. It's not the world that we live in, because the public and college basketball and college football have a place in the overall world, I guess, that women's college soccer doesn't.
I felt like I gave 130% every time I went off on the court, yet the guys always had more people at their games, or they always had more money that they were raising. It always was feeling like my effort was never good enough. So I think from that standpoint, it was really tough for our team, you know, knowing that we had a really special group of kids that were running together or playing basketball together, and we were breaking different records for our schools. It was really hard when a guy's game, they weren't really breaking any records, and it wasn't as great, would have four times the amount of people that were there. That was really tough.
Games changed a lot, but the things I don't like about the women's games is they still can't get people to come watch them, and I don't understand it. You know, they're practicing and playing, and you go to the assembly hall, and there's 1,000 people there, 2,000 people there. But it's hard to play in front of not a full house. You know, it's been 30 years since I graduated, and hopefully they'll continue to keep getting people in the stands.
Certainly, women's rights in athletics have come a long ways in the 3 decades since Title IX became law. Due to continued vigilance, changes in policies, and growing public interest, college women's athletics has become something that advocates not so long ago only dreamed about.
If anyone had said to me, even when I was graduating from college, Janet, one day you'll sit in a stadium with 90,000 people watching the U.S. women's national team take on China, I would have said, are you crazy? We'll never get 90,000 people in a women's soccer game. You know, we were excited to get 3,000 people, you know, a year ago in Keenan Stadium. Are you going to tell me there's going to be 65,000 people in Atlanta, Georgia, watching a women's soccer game? And Mia Hamm, who I worked camps with, is going to become a common name? No way is that going to happen. And so some of the things that have happened, I couldn't have even dreamed about. So when you ask me about the next generation, dream big, because it's hard for me to even imagine what your generation might have opportunity to do, because I can't even imagine some of the people who literally were my generation, some of the opportunities and things that they've had the opportunity to do. You know, there's certain things that have gone on that you just feel really fortunate that it did happen during your lifetime, that you're able to see that and know that that's going to open doors for women, and doors that you don't even know about, doors you don't know are going to be opened, and things that you don't know are going to happen. And the day will come where there's 90,000 people every weekend to see a women's soccer game. And people will say I'm crazy, but I would have said you were crazy if you told me there was going to be one day that there were 90,000 people, much less multiple days.
The final step will be something that legislation cannot solve. The idea that every person in society will look and evaluate a person or value a person for their strengths, that's something intangible. That's something in the character of our society. It will have to be something that we will grow towards, something that we will learn. And it probably will not be our generation that learns it. It will be our kids.
Watching college sports today, we are accustomed to seeing teams made up of people from all corners of the globe and from different social economic backgrounds. Sadly, this has not always been the case. During the years of racial segregation enforced by Jim Crow laws, and even as the civil rights movement gained momentum in the 1950s, sports teams rarely included African American athletes. However, as more people recognized talent, things slowly started to change. Skin color became less of an issue. While not without struggle, these African-American athletes accomplished a great deal, overcoming economic hardships and little access to sports. Many were supported by their families and primary schools.
Well, let me say, Gary, Indiana, my mother and my father, they moved there from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. For some reason, my mom and my dad were not together, and there were six of us. I had three brothers and two sisters, and we all stayed with our mother. And as a result of that, we were moving around kind of rapidly, involved in trying to live a life where we did not have a lot of economic situations. All I know is that they had what they call welfare. And as a result of that, we were able to live comfortably.
You know, the thing that was very important to us is that we had pretty targeted goals. The way our family was developed, my father was supposed to make sure I had enough athletic talent to go to a big school like University of Illinois. My mother was to make sure I was academically sound enough to go there. You know, after a while, that's the way you live. It wasn't like you woke up every day frustrated about it. I mean, that's just the way it was. And there were very good things happening to you. My time at parochial school, I was getting a good education. I was learning about a lot of things.
School was just so enjoyable. In grade school, they did have compulsory physical education. And as a result of that, at the end of the year, when the Gary Post Tribune, that was a newspaper, they would have a grade school track meet every year. And we were able to win our events. She would win the dash, and I would win the dash also. And also, I learned how to hurdle.
Racism has negatively affected the lives of many people. Not only were African Americans given limited opportunities to participate in sports, but they were treated differently in other areas as well.
When I was in high school, they had an African American league in Southern Illinois. They had about 12 or 15 teams in that league, and they were not allowed to play in the IHSA tournaments until 1946, which is the year we won the state tournament. You know, and they didn't really have an opportunity to advance much in the tournaments because of their conditions in their schools. Not good. They didn't have the coaching or the facilities.
School always came easy to me. Probably the toughest part is socially. You know, again, that's a very difficult time. Now you would see interracial dating, and it's not such a big thing. But back then, it was a huge thing. And it was okay if I played with little Johnny, but if I wanted to talk to little Susie, that was a little bit different. Not only was it not accepted by parents, it was frowned upon by school administrators. It was frowned upon by, you know, my classmates. So I think that was probably the difficult part, is just trying to fit in at an age when everybody's just trying to fit in. But when you have something that makes you different, it just makes it that much more difficult.
My friends, a lot of my best friends didn't even go to the school. You know, you knew after a game, and you would head home in a town where you have a significant black population in a segregated school. It's going to be like anything else. You know, the team splits up, and there are guys that head off to the subsidized housing, and there's guys that head off to the campus where I lived. And that was one of the beautiful things about it, is even with those differences, you know, the fact that you could come together and play like a team for a period of time, and then you just went your own way. I don't think people understand that. You can really have an affection for people that you play sports with when you're playing on a team and have minimum contact with them outside the team. But at the same time, some people enjoy that. I mean, you're bringing these people together that are different, and not just racially different, but they're different in terms of their socioeconomic conditions and their outlook on life and all that. But for a period of time, you could come together and play like a team.
Every person we meet can change our lives forever. Two of our interviewees remember vividly how one encounter launched them into their athletic careers.
When we got to high school, the main thing that turned my life around was when my coach, Coach Mallett, invited Jesse Owens to come speak. And that was the change of my life. When he came in, he was sitting down at the table, and when they said Jesse Owens, we didn't know who he was at first. Then when our coach explained that he was the best sprinter in the entire world. He ran in the Berlin Olympics in 1936, and he won the 100, the 200, the low hurdles, the long jump. The stadium was packed, and when Jesse Owens finished talking, I went home that night, And I told my mother, I said, Mom, I think that I want to break one of the world records that Jesse Owens set in Berlin, Germany. She said, well, you work at it, and I think you can do it. With that feeling, that motivated me to be not only a good athlete, but knowing that you had to be a good student also in order to go to college. And after that, my high school career turned to what I call the essence of running.
I grew up in a segregated state in the town of Columbia, South Carolina, so I had planned to go to a university that was all black. So that's where I had intended to go, except I was blessed to have a grocery store in my neighborhood who, you know, the owner happened to be white, but he knew that a guy named Buddy Young, who was an Afro-American football player, had played at the University of Illinois, and he thought that my athletic ability, I could come to the University of Illinois and get a fair chance to make the football team and would be treated right. And so he was just saying that, I believe that this JC guy can go to the University of Illinois and do what Buddy Young did. They're just, you know, people in the community talking. But where is he going to go? Well, that's the only big university I know. Well, what about the two universities right behind you? Well, we think he can play on a better level. We think this guy can play on a white university, and we think his opportunity to be better at a white university.
Walking on campus today, the U of I is clearly a university that has come a long way in diversity since the 1960s. Before that time, there were just a few hundred African Americans on campus with tens of thousands of students. In 1968, a program called Project 500 was put into effect to recruit about 500 African American and Latino students to the University of Illinois campus. It was the first program of its kind in the nation to try to diversify the university population in this way. Though the project was ultimately successful, it was initially seen to have both positive and negative effects.
My assignment was to identify units, departments who were involved in the recruitment, advising, and counseling on campus and help them find ways to increase the enrollment of these students who, prior to this experience, had not been admitted. In 1967, for example, there were 52 African Americans in the freshman class. In 1968, there were 600 plus. So the campus, you know, the community was quite ready for that kind of a dramatic increase in people of color. It was called 500 because the plan was to admit these students to a number equal to the same percentage of, say, African Americans in the population of the state. They settled for 500, hence the name Project 500. People tended to respond to their presence. Some didn't even know they were here. Some were angry because they felt that these students had taken the places of people who were more worthy. Some were very unhappy because they just don't like black people to begin with, because obviously people bring to this campus the biases and prejudices and view of the world that they've learned at home, and that was a problem. It's still a problem, I think.
These interviewees have all faced discrimination sometime during their life, including at the U of I. Some of these athletes remember situations where they were treated unfairly, not only on the institutional level, but on the individual level as well, and recall how they fought against the injustice.
I was actually arrested once when I was in school. A teammate of mine, Mike Bellamy, was drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles, and we decided to throw a draft party to celebrate. And it was a predominantly white bar, and we rented out the basement. So here comes 45 to 50 football players. Here comes 12 to 13 basketball players. It was mostly a black party. And then maybe you'd see one or two university police officers that would be out there just making sure that kids are behaving and, you know, nobody's doing anything wrong. But this particular night, when we came out from under the basement of CAMS, there were probably 15 to 20 police officers and a fire truck that was out there. And it was obvious that they had gotten word that there was going to be this party, and they were there in force. I think they all were there waiting to see what was going to happen. And I kind of made that point to the police officers. I was like, why would you show up in such force when on a normal night you wouldn't do this? And then what in the world were you thinking when you brought a fire truck? Have you not seen the race riots of the 1960s? Do you not know the image of a fire hose and spraying people down on a sidewalk? And if you're trying to prevent a riot, that was the wrong move to bring a fire truck. And the police officer kind of told me, well, son, you know, I appreciate what you're saying, but you just need to mind your own business and be quiet. And this is maybe one of the dumbest things I've ever said in my life is when I told him, well, I'm a political science major. He wasn't so impressed by that. Within two more minutes, I was handcuffed, thrown in the back of the car. But I don't know that people were as sensitive to those issues as maybe they should have been. And it was shocking because it wasn't the bar owner. It was not fellow students. This was the police department.
When I was like a sophomore, I was the best sprinter at Illinois, and I found out that so many athletes were getting stipends, and I wasn't. So I said, there's something wrong with this, and no one could give me an answer why they were getting $25 or $30 a month. So what I did, I got on the bus and went home. They started looking for me, and they called the mayor of Gary. He called me, and he said, Willie, what's the problem? He said, why aren't you back in school? Don't you want to be a coach too? I said, yes, I do, but they're not treating me like they're treating the other athletes. So he said, what is it? Well, I told him, I said, they're paying these athletes. He said, okay, I'm going to call them, and right now, here, you take this money and you go on back to school. So I came on back to school. And when I got back, then they started treating me like the other athletes that were on the team.
You can easily say, I didn't get this opportunity because of that. But, you know, sports is sort of subjective aspect to it. You know, coaches and players and parents always don't agree on the talent of the player. And so, I think it's too easy to say I didn't get that opportunity because of that. But in the back of my mind, I thought that had I not been black, that situation might have been different. I mean, I don't want to point to any particular individuals, but, you know, I do feel like there was at least one opportunity when somebody would just tell you, I don't think you could play without them actually seeing you play. And then put you through a situation where you would literally, even though you're on the team, they sort of make you make the team over again. And then when you made the team again, they would say to you, but I don't think you can play. And then what made this thing so strange is when you decide to quit the team, because I decided to quit playing basketball to go on to play football, a comment to me was, we're sorry to see you do that because you were really coming along.
This is 1996, 1997. Mm-hmm. So we're on this team, and one of the teachers of the school heard kids saying racial slurs. And so when they brought our team in, it was really interesting because I realized right then that if you aren't exposed to diversity, then you can really have some opinions that can be portrayed by the media. And, you know, people say that, but I thought that is so not true. Who actually believes that stuff? You know, and then sitting there and listening to people, I thought, oh my gosh, they really do believe that's true. So it was very, very eye-opening for me. I remember really having to say over and over again, I don't particularly care what your belief system is regarding my race, but you will respect me, period. That is a non-negotiable point. So what you say that's offensive, fine, but you have to respect other races. And if you choose to, beyond that, believe something about that particular race, then I can't stop you from doing that. But, you know, I can enforce and expect your respect because I'm a human on this earth just as you are. And if nothing else, you should respect me for that purpose.
People will treat you differently. And you have to understand, sometimes they're treating you better than they treat your neighbor who live across the street from you, because they know who you are or they see you on TV. But I don't try to prejudge anybody. I just try to make sure that I understand that I'm a human being, you're a human being, you treat me with respect, I'll treat you with respect, and I accept the way you treat me. I also understand if you don't treat me with respect, sometimes it's the environment that you grew up in, or sometimes it's the environment that we're located in, but I have to make those adjustments as they come.
Since the 1950s, the University of Illinois has opened its doors to people with disabilities. The U of I was the first university in the nation to offer a post-secondary education to people with disabilities, and it was also the first school to have a collegiate wheelchair basketball team. Since those early beginnings, the U of I has been at the forefront of accommodations and opportunities for people with disabilities, attracting them from across the country.
I was injured when I was 4 years old. I fell out of a 12-story window. I used to live in an apartment building in Falls Church, Virginia, and I was in my bedroom. I was supposed to be taking a nap. I had a pretty wide windowsill in my bedroom, and so I climbed up on the windowsill to get something off of a bookshelf that was next to the window. And while I was walking across, I leaned backwards, and unbeknownst to me, the window was open. And it was back when they used to use pop-out screens, and the screen popped out, and I fell. I ended up smashing my femurs. I dislocated my hips, and I bruised my spinal cord. From that, I wasn't able to walk.
When I was 21 years old in 1975, I had gotten involved in doing trail riding and motorcycles. I just bought a new bike, and I was training, and I was in a gravel pit, and I fell about 80 feet and broke my back.
During November of my freshman year, I was riding on a brand new bike. I was coming home from a babysitting job, and I came around a corner too sharply, and my pedal dug into the cement. I fell in my hip, and it dislocated. And the reason my hip dislocated so easily was because of the spina bifida. It changed some of the bone structure in my hips, and so my hip dislocated quite easily. I had 5 hip operations. But after I got my last body cast off, we found out none of the surgeries worked. Just sitting up in bed, trying to get my hips and knees flexible again, my hip dislocated.
Despite having different disabilities, all of these people struggle to find acceptance in the able-bodied community. For many, sports are an outlet for releasing their emotions and overcoming their physical boundaries.
Before I dislocated my hip, I was able to walk. And people seem to be more comfortable with me, even though my walking gait was different. The wheelchair, people were not as comfortable with that. And I remember distinctly when I went back to high school, second semester, that sophomore year, everybody knew Gene up and walking around. And that's the only way I knew myself. People would talk to me with their head down, their eyes down. They wouldn't give me eye contact. Some of them, quote unquote, felt sorry for me. I didn't want them to feel sorry for me. I just wanted my friends back. So it took me a long time to get over the sadness and the anger of those surgeries not working. For my junior year, I'm at this new high school, and there was another kid who also used a wheelchair, also had spina bifida. He said, "Hey, Gene, why don't you try wheelchair soccer?" And I was like, "Wheelchair soccer? How do you play wheelchair soccer? You need your legs to play soccer." And he's like, "Oh, it's this really cool adapted sport." And I heard that word adapted and boop, 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 sirens went off. I was like, "No way. It's not real sport. I am not going to go do wheelchair soccer." So this guy invited me September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May. Finally, May of that year, I thought, you know, the only way I'm going to get this guy off my back is to go to one soccer practice, and I know I'm not going to like it, but at least he'll get off my back. So I went to the soccer practice, and it was nothing like I thought it was going to be. Chairs are crashing and banging, bodies are flying, and I thought, this is sport. This is real sport. A whole new world opened up to me.
The U of I is known worldwide as one of the top universities for people with disabilities due to its efforts and initiatives undertaken in the past.
I think a lot of times out of pain come great things. In World War II, a lot of pain, and a lot of men returning from the war without legs and with spinal cord injuries had the guts to march on Springfield to demand that they were going to go back to school. And that, no, they were not going to be sent to some vocational rehab type program where they're taught a menial occupation. They wanted to go to school. And so they marched on it. And the work of Tim Nugent and what he wanted, he knocked down some doors. It was a skate for me when I got here. I mean, here I thought we were blazing a trail, but it was nothing compared to what Tim Nugent had done in this community.
He built the first ramps on campus and would move them from building to building so students could get in and out of the buildings. He knocked on professors' doors and requested that they move classes on the third floor to the first floor, and sometimes they were willing to do that, and sometimes they weren't. Tim started the National Wheelchair Basketball Association. There were just so many things that came out of Tim's proactive efforts to create educational opportunities for people with disabilities that it changed the world. The first curb cuts were here in Champaign. The first buses with a lift were here in Champaign. And first college wheelchair sports teams were here in Champaign. So because things got going in the late 40s, by the time I came in the late 80s, people weren't thinking twice about providing services for students with disabilities. It was almost the culture.
Because of this history, the U of I attracts people with disabilities from all over the country.
I did my rehabilitation at Boston University Medical Center. I was very fortunate. The gentleman who was the lead physician knew Tim Nugent, and he knew of my interest in athletics, and he knew I'd probably needed to get my grades up to get in here. So I went back to school, did my associate's degree in a year, and I came out here actually for my first nationals in 1980 at Champaign-Urbana. And while I was out visiting, I went over and met with Dr. Nugent and his staff, and I knew this is where I needed to be if I wanted to pursue athletics as a career.
When I started beginning to apply to schools and things like that, I realized that I was looking at all these other schools, and subconsciously I was comparing every school I saw to the University of Illinois. Because when I came out here, people with disabilities were just fully integrated into everything. And as I began looking around the country for where to go to college, I was feeling frustrated that so many schools were not accessible. I knew that U of I was the top school as far as disability accommodations and wheelchair accessibility. I decided, you know, let's just see what Illinois has to offer, and here I am.
I was spotted playing wheelchair soccer by the wheelchair basketball coach here at the University of Illinois. That was Brad Hedrick. He saw me playing an exhibition game of wheelchair soccer and came up and said, "How would you like to be a member of the University of Illinois women's wheelchair basketball team?" And I let him go through his whole spiel, and I was like, "Oh, no, thank you." I listened politely, but Brad kept sending me letters and he kept calling me, and I was really flattered because nobody had ever sought me out to be part of a team like that before. I was always the last person picked on the playground, the last person picked when we had physical education classes. So the fact that this guy wanted me on his team made me feel really good.
For many people, coming to the U of I was a life-changing experience. The university's unique environment allows athletic and academic growth that is hard for the disabled to find elsewhere.
I think my first experience here at U of I was kind of like a kid walking into a candy store. I was blown away by all the thousands of student organizations and opportunities that I just didn't realize existed. That was something that I really missed in high school, because student organizations at my high school were never open to me. They would meet on the second floor and I couldn't get there. So for me to come to this campus, I was just blown away by all the choices. And I mean, it was wonderful.
When I arrived at the University of Illinois, there were higher expectations placed on me. Disability could no longer be an excuse for anything, because the coaches had physical disabilities. The people who were becoming lawyers and who had won Olympic gold medals, they also had disabilities, but they didn't limit themselves. Once I arrived in Champaign-Urbana, that I finally realized our biggest limitations are the ones we place on ourselves, or the ones we allow others to place on us. That was a huge lesson I learned once I got on campus.
In order to compete, athletes must have support and motivation from coaches. Many times, these exemplary coaches are some of the people who make the greatest impact on their athletes' lives and help them not only pursue their athletic dreams, but their life goals as well.
I probably learned the most from my track coach when I first came to school here, Marty Morse. He was an amazing man, just a wealth of information about the history of racing, about different techniques in racing. I mean, in 2 years, he turned me from one of the top junior wheelchair racers in the country, just the country, to one of the top racers in my class in the world. In 2 years, he had me competing at the Paralympic Games in Athens, Greece. I started with the goal of just making the U.S. team. And then when I made the team, my goal changed to, you know, oh, I want to make the finals in every event that I run. And then I got over to Athens, and in the very first race that I ran, a prelim for the 400 meters, I posted the fastest time of the day and set a Paralympic record. But then beyond Marty, my basketball coach, Mike Frogley, my game has gotten exponentially better on the basketball court because of him. I couldn't have asked for a better group of coaches since I've been here.
Marty Morse is one of the most influential, if not the most influential person in my life. He's the person who saw things in me that I didn't see in myself and proceeded to pull these things out and develop me when I had no idea what he was doing. It took him 2 years to talk me into doing a marathon. I had no interest in doing a marathon. But he said, Gene, you're strong enough. I think you can do it. And so I did the Chicago Marathon. And then I qualified for Boston. And I didn't want to do any more marathons. And he's like, Gene, you qualified for Boston. You have to do it. People dream about qualifying. And he talked me into doing Boston. And when I got it to Boston, I didn't think I belonged in the race. And all of a sudden, I won my first Boston Marathon and broke the world record by almost 7 minutes. He had influence not only athletically, but personally, and just building up that inner strength and that vision for what my life could be beyond athletics. He was a very influential figure in my life.
For those with disabilities, competitive collegiate athletics is just as rewarding as for their able-bodied counterparts, where a sense of family, team, and acceptance can be found among their fellow athletes.
Last year, we started this thing called the Ultimate Basketball Challenge, where after the basketball season for able-bodied and wheelchair is over, we get together for a game where the able-bodied men's and women's basketball teams sit down in wheelchairs and they play a game with us. And, you know, that opened a lot of their eyes to what exactly it is we're doing, and all of them loved it. I think every single basketball player that participated in it had a blast. It's just kind of cool to have that connection.
My first international event was in Stoke Mandeville in Great Britain. We got there for a basketball tournament. It's my first basketball tournament internationally ever. So we got to the athlete's village, and I immediately went and found the gym so I could start shooting around. And I'm shooting around, and then a guy from Jordan came in, and he asked if he could shoot with me. Didn't know a lot of English, but he started shooting around. Then a guy from Greece came in, and a guy from Turkey, and a guy from France and the Netherlands. All of a sudden, we had 10 guys there, all from different countries, but we started playing a pickup basketball game.
However, all too often, people with disabilities have not been given the recognition or help they deserve from the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Because of this lack of institutional support, these athletes have often had to find their own opportunities and funding to continue their athletic careers.
I paid for probably my first 5 international trips to coach, so I paid to go work 80-hour work weeks, 3 weeks in a row in Great Britain. I think I paid for my first Paralympic coaching experience. In this country, a lot of the money goes towards persons with mental incapacities as opposed to persons with physical disabilities. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have the able-bodied athletes, and that's where the corporations come in and they put their money into it. So we sort of fall right in the middle. Sometimes we get the hand-me-downs from Team USA, the able-bodied teams, or we paid our own way. Even now, it's not unusual for our teams to go on international trips and be told that they need to raise $2,500 before they can go.
The two instances I always remember at the Paralympics that remind me of the weaknesses of the areas that we still got to grow in. I remember being in Atlanta for the Paralympics in 1996. And I remember going on to the athlete's village and seeing that one of the booths outside the village, a McDonald's, was being torn down. McDonald's was a sponsor of the Olympics that year. And I got onto the village and I asked one of the people, I said, what's the deal here with McDonald's? They're tearing their stuff down. We've still got another event. One of the people told me that McDonald's did not want to have anything to do with the Paralympics, but would not let another fast food company come on board to sponsor the Paralympics. You know, it wasn't quite good enough for McDonald's to spend money on, but they didn't want anybody else to be able to support it. And then in Athens in 2004, the lady that was largely responsible for the Olympics and Paralympics was planning to run for political office. She wanted to use the Olympics as her platform, but she didn't want to be associated with the Paralympics because she didn't want to be tied to the Paralympics and disability. And so you still see, even at the very highest levels, they see difference in people with disabilities and they see it as a negative thing. They don't see the ability.
Since the disability rights movement in the late 1980s and passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, many things have improved in the U.S. However, improvements are still needed for there to be equal opportunities, and many misconceptions still exist about people with disabilities. Athletics can be a bridge to understanding.
The first thing I'd like to see us grow towards is having the same kinds of competitive opportunities for student athletes with disabilities as their peers have. As an example, at the high school level, I'd like to see a high school wheelchair basketball throughout the state of Illinois. I'd like to see the same thing happen at the college level, where instead of there being, say, 10 wheelchair basketball teams around the country on the men's side and 3 on the women's side, I'd like to see there be 50. I'd like to see that happen because there's so much that I've learned from my involvement in wheelchair sports. And I know that those same things can be of benefit to other people with disabilities. And I know that there are kids out there that, if given the opportunity to play wheelchair basketball, would do it in a heartbeat and would benefit as I've benefited, or even more greatly.
A lot of people aren't sure or aren't aware of the fact that if you have a disability, there still are a lot of things that you can do. People with disabilities can be independent. People with disabilities can be intelligent. People with disabilities can do all sorts of things that sometimes people don't realize they can do. And so one of the roles that I have embraced as a person with a disability, but also a public figure, is the opportunity to educate about disability. In my mind, walking is overrated. I think that walking is really handy, but it's not the only way to get around in life.
What's interesting about sport and disability when you look at the two of them, sport is all about physical ability. And our idea of people who are athletes, we always say they're physically the best. And what's neat about sport for people with disabilities is that most often when we look at a person with a disability, we don't see them as being physical anymore. For me, at least, what was neat about wheelchair basketball is it showed that I could still be physical. While part of me doesn't work, my legs don't work in the same way that they used to. I don't have control over them. It showed that I still have muscles that can be used. I still have a physical component to myself. When I learned these things as I was growing, and what I've seen in the student athletes that I've worked with, is that they start to recognize that physical side of themselves. They learn that they can be great wheelchair basketball players, and they begin to think, hey, I wonder if I can also be a great student, or a great mom, or a great dad, or a great teacher, great lawyer. It sparks that self-confidence in them, and I think other people, when they see our student athletes, it begins to change the way they view people who are just walking around or who have some kind of a difference.
The U of I has come a long way since its programs for people with disabilities began in the 1950s.
Over the years, we have definitely grown. I've sat down and I've talked with Dr. Nugent, the founder of our program, and he'll talk about there was no money in the program at all for any scholarships or any travel or anything. The players in the early teams back in the late 40s and early 50s, they used their own personal vehicles to drive to games. They used their own gas money. So we've come a long, long ways since that time. We weren't allowed to use the name Fighting Illini for many of the early years. Our student athletes can receive varsity letters for their athletic accomplishments. They can receive the Huff Award for their academic achievements as varsity athletes. We travel on a charter bus now instead of using our own personal vehicles. We have some financial assistance we can help our athletes with now. There's still a long way to go. We're not fully recognized and treated as the other varsity athletes on campus. That's the next thing we want to do, is really work towards that.
The future for people with disabilities appears bright. Negative attitudes are changing, and in the words of Jean Driscoll, many people now see that having a disability isn't an inability.
I think the first thing that people do when they see a person in a wheelchair is they think, oh, this person can't walk, that a person can't do. And I think what's neat when you look at our student athletes is when you start watching them play wheelchair basketball and you see the phenomenal athleticism that they have and the skill that they've got. You stop thinking about what they can't do and you're just remarking at what they can do and the phenomenal ability. We've got kids that'll go out and they'll shoot 60% from the three-point line in wheelchair basketball. It's the same shot that Trent Meacham's taken, you know, same shot that Lori Bjork's taken on the women's team. I'd like to see people look and say, wow, I know that Steve Cirio, one of our wheelchair basketball players, I know he's in a chair and that's really different, but look at how good he is at shooting threes. Then the next time that person who's maybe come and seen one of our games does is when they're in, say, the mall, they're walking along, they see somebody in a wheelchair, they don't think that person can't go upstairs. They think, I wonder if that person plays wheelchair basketball. I wonder if they can shoot basket. I wonder what else they can do. And imagine if we can get society to look at all people and see and acknowledge difference as being a positive thing and focus on the abilities so that we value people on the merits of their character, their principles, their values, and their skills, and not on the negative things.
Although these interviewees have come from different backgrounds, their passion for sports binds them together. These athletes have experienced a great deal of trials and hardships throughout their careers and have learned and grown from them, becoming motivated, disciplined, and self-confident.
You learn how to deal with adversity through sports. You know, I broke my collarbone. That was a setback. I was cut from basketball, and that's definitely humiliating. It messes with your self-esteem, overcoming that adversity. Teaches how to be a team player, how to care more about the team than you do yourself. Teaches you how to handle success. Teaches you humility that, you know, just because you win and you're the best doesn't mean you necessarily have to go around bragging about it. You learn how to meet people. You learn how to bond with people quickly. You know, learn how to accept people for their differences. You know, some of my best friends have all come through sports. You learn how to be confrontational. You can't be on a good team and not be willing to jump a teammate's case that they're not doing their job. So I learned so much through athletics.
I think they teach you to make decisions. They enhance your horizon about how to evaluate what your environment is like and what's going to work for you and what's not. I think that ethics are learned in sport. I think self-discipline, commitment, learning to be involved in the pursuit of excellence. I think all of those things can be derived and learned in the realm of sport.
My advice would be to not expect to put in anything less than a lot of hard work. Being a student athlete is challenging, and so if it's something that you're looking to do, you really have to step back and ask yourself, do I really love competing athletically this much? Am I really willing to give up some different opportunities so that I could create other opportunities for myself in sports?
So what lessons can we learn about the struggles for equality in athletics?
When I was coming along, one of the things that was always important to me is I looked around the people that I had in education and that I had in college and so forth. Those people were at the same place for a long time, and I think that's a dimension that doesn't happen quite so much today. But I wanted to be somewhere long enough to make a difference. That's one reason why I stayed at Illinois for 36 years. The second thing is that I think to make a difference and want to make a difference is very, very important if you want to be a leader. Because a lot of people don't want to take risks. And I think one of the things that you need to do is to learn how to take risks and also to make decisions.
I heard a comedian say this the other day, and I think this is a lot of the way that I've lived my life, is that he said, you know, because he was a comedian, he said that every situation he got into, the first thing he thought about was, how could I make this a great story? No, it wasn't just that if you met the president, you'd go, yeah, make the president. But, you know, could I step on his foot? I mean, how could I make it like a better story? And so to this day, you're actually hunting out, how could this be a great story?
Most collegiate athletes will never become a professional, but many do continue their involvement in sports. Jean Driscoll, who is now retired from wheelchair racing, continues to share her experiences through motivational speaking, inspiring others to look high and dream big.
I've had the opportunity to influence everybody on the platform. It's incredible. I could have never scripted that I would win 8 Boston Marathons and 2 Olympic medals, and people invite me to come and speak, you know, in front of audiences of 8,000 or 8. I love being able to speak to people and help them recognize that the biggest limitations are the ones they place on themselves or the ones they allow others to place on them. I love being able to help them dream big. That is my life motto. Dream big and work hard. You have to see yourself doing big things. You have to see your name in marquee lights. I use that as an analogy, but if you don't see it, you're not going to shoot that high. Heck, I tell people shoot even higher than that. I've received many emails, many letters, and I get really kind feedback from people who have talked about what they've learned. And if I can take life lessons that I've learned and pass them on before people have to learn things the hard way, then I enjoy that.
May our love forever be true while we're marching along life's pathways. May the spirit of old Illinois keep us marching and singing with you and my spirit for our heroes, Illinois.
We hope you enjoyed Competing Against Discrimination, Achieving Equality in Athletics at the University of Illinois. This program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Catherine Allen, Catherine Floas, Sheila Gogola, Yu Yang Gu, and Adam Joseph. The executive producers are Maria Gao and Anne Macheski.
Hail to the orange, hail to the blue. Hail, alma mater, ever so true, we love no other, so let our motto be, victory,
Interviews were conducted by the 2011 University Laboratory High School sub-freshman class. Stories were contributed by Ted Beach, Becky Beach, J.C. Caroline, Tony Clements, Jean Driscoll, and Jolly Forber Pratt, Michael Frogley, Joshua George, Carol Kars, Kathy Kaler, Gia Lewis, Marty Morris, Janet Rayfield, Clarence Shelley, Sean Wax, and William Williams. For more information on this project, please visit our website at will.illinois.edu.
This program was directed by Dave Dickey of AM 580 and University Laboratory High School teacher Janet Morford. I'm Anne Macheski.
And I'm Maria Gao.